This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
This is Susan Robb for New Books Network, Children and Family Literature. And today I'm talking with Melissa Sweet, who has illustrated close to 100 books for young people, ranging from board books to picture books. She's also done nonfiction titles and has won a number of awards, including the Orbis Pictus and Caldecott honors for her books. She most recently has done a magnificent book called Some Writer, which is the story of E.B. White. And it's one of, I have to say, Melissa, it's really one of the most unusually illustrated books that I've seen. Just so much of the way that you've handled presenting different parts of the illustration just really jumped out at me. And there are pieces with music scores factored into the illustration, an old typewriter with the keys carrying through. And so you just get so much of a beautiful sense of sort of a celebration of the whole idea of what it has meant to be a writer. But talk to me first, if you would, a little bit about how you came to want to do a book on E.B. White.
Well, thank you, Susan, for mentioning the illustration and design. We can talk more about that because it was integral in figuring out how to craft this book. But I was not one of those people who was an E.B. White aficionado, for instance, in terms of his children's books. I came to him more from the elements of style, known as Struck in White, Struck in White's elements of style. And I, for the better part of my adult life, I had no idea E.B. White was the White in Struck in White. So this is a wonderful book of grammar with a lot of wit in it. And what I love most about it is this wonderful guidelines at the back called An Approach to Style. So I came to E.B. White at wanting to become a writer very late in life. And I had done a lot of biographies. And my editor and I were kicking around a few ideas. Some I had, you know, fleshed out pretty well, but nothing was gelling. And I just thought, wow, if I could do a biography on anybody, who would I do? And who would it be? And it was, and E.B. White popped into my head, and it was one of those passions, like, and then somebody put an uncut diamond in your lap. You just want to, like, take really good care of this idea. And I think part of it was the opportunity to do the research for someone like E.B. White and uncover where his stories came from and what kind of child he was and what kind of person he was. And mostly I wanted to know, did writing come easy to him? Everything I've read of his just had this feeling that I liken it to snow, like the first snow on a wooden path. It's like all the snowflakes fall, and it's just quiet and perfect and memorable. But being a writer, that's not my experience of getting there. I have always found the process somewhat arduous and exciting, but I was really curious to know how it was for him. So that was the impetus for the book, and especially for young readers to learn that, you know, who this, you know, classic American, beloved American writer, how he came to be a writer.
And, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that struck me in reading about this, and it's funny in talking about elements of style, because one of the things about elements of style is it's so just such an example of perfect brevity. I mean, it just gets every single thing across. There's, you know, it's a tiny, tiny little book. I remember the first time, you know, working in a bookstore that I saw it and people, you know, had it for people. And it was just, you know, this thing, but it's like every single, you know, inch of it is packed with what you just need to know. And it's kind of iconic for what that is. And it's funny because that's the thing about E.B. White's children's books. They just stand so separately. I mean, people have said that Charlotte's Web is, you know, considered by many the best children's book. I mean, that's a whole, you know, question you don't want to mess around with. But in fact, it just stands out as such a magnificent, magnificent book, as do his others. So talk to me about that, about just E.B. White as a writer and how you feel he came at a story.
Like many writers, or I say most writers, his stories, you know how people often say the story found me? There's a tiny element of that to E.B. White and to the rest of us. We're at a place in our life that a story comes along and we grab it. That same story a few years before, we might not have even thought about it. He was a writer from the time he was a little boy, because the nature of communicating with his older siblings is he had to become a letter writer. Yet in order to communicate with them, they wrote letters back and forth. That was just the way it was at the turn of the century. And so when he wrote poems and stories and all of it for fun. So when his being, he was a New Yorker writer and writing plenty, when the idea of writing a children's book came up, how do I want to say it? It was, so Stuart Little, in a nutshell, was a dream. But that dream had to be written down, and he did, and he kept adding to it. And I think that it wasn't as if he said, I want to be a children's book writer. He was a writer, and he did this myriad of types of writing, you know, from essays to poems to children's books. So it was, it was at a time in his life that he was being encouraged to write a book for children. And Stuart Little, I think, even though it was fairly fleshed out, it took some careful editing. But especially with Charlotte's Web, the idea for this story came from a couple of divergent episodes in his life, one about a pig on his farm who had died, and then him seeing a spider in his barn spinning an egg sack. And to many of us, we see all sorts of divergent things happen in front of us all day long. But these two things captured him, and he later wondered if they were the beginnings of the story. These two episodes merged together. When we look back and think of Charlotte's Web, and you know, some people say maybe the most perfect children's book of all time, maybe the most perfect book of all time. Mm-hmm. I think it was a wonderful, perfect storm of a lot of writing, and then he set it aside, which I think is a writer's best friend often, when you don't quite know where a story is going or how to resolve it, set it aside. He came back to it, he added to it, and it was painstaking editing. I think he maintained that he had an ear for writing, and that he wasn't a great reader, that he wasn't a literary fellow, as are his own words. But I think he listened to conversation, and he understood how to craft a scene, or, you know, and how to use all the devices of writing, plot, background, all the small devices that are, you know, we learn in fifth grade. He knew all that like the back of his hand. And I think one of the things that made it so unusual when it was published in the 1950s is that it dealt with death, something that children's books hadn't, but in such a poignant way that it was very, very memorable. And it was sort of an everyday thing, a spider. You know, who among us thinks about the death of a spider? But in his story, it was everything. It was, mm-hmm. It represented every friend we ever loved. So I think he dealt with some interesting issues, and also I'm starting the story with that wonderful first sentence that always blows my mind. I love talking with young readers about this kid when I go to school, because it is pretty remarkable that he got to where is Papa going with that axe, mm-hmm. from many, many iterations, but had this wonderful first sentence that grabbed the reader and made you want to keep going. And he went from, you know, having some very quiet first sentences to this action-packed one from the point of view of an 8-year-old. Mm-hmm. So he understood when to keep going and when to stop.
One of the things that I was thinking when you were talking about that, it's interesting too with Charlotte's Web, how you really get a feel for a child's view of the world, you know, all the kinds of things you see where adults have grown up past that and see things differently and supposedly more clearly, but yet maybe not. And then also mm-hmm. the idea of respecting everyone, sort of everyone's point of view. And you see that across, you know, across with the different animals, everybody being very different. It's, you know, sort of a cacophony of different points of view, but not from where you'd expect.
Right, and exactly. He had a great way of portraying it, and I think part of the pleasure of reading his death book, and Stuart Little for sure, is the conceit, the idea that the grown-ups are a little bit clueless, but everybody else knows what's going on and can you know, watch it from afar. I love that wit in amongst all the, you know, all the worry and tragedy and everything that's going on behind the scenes in Charlotte's Web, or not behind the scenes. Those are the scenes. So it's wonderful that he had that dual way of making us see a story, enjoying the story that way.
And let me ask you about anthropomorphism, which is always I find fascinating of, you know, oftentimes when people head into the idea of, oh, I saw something out my back window, I think I can write a children's book and I want to write it about that animal, you know, a squirrel in the backyard sort of situation. What is it, do you think, that makes anthropomorphizing, when does it work, I guess, is my question.
Well, that's a great question. When I first started being interested in children's literature, I remember reading Frog and Toad, and it never occurred to me that they were a frog and a toad. They were just two people with a friendship and this fantastic dialogue. And so I think when it works is when you feel a universality about it, that we don't care so much about what the person looks like. That's not part of it. It's who they are, maybe. And yet with Frog and Toad, I mean, there were elements of them that were frog and toad-like. And E.B. White knew his barnyard animals very intimately. I think it's only natural for humans to find those human characteristics that we can kind of poke fun at the geese saying everything three times and being a little annoying, and the sheep being worriers and telling Wilbur, you know, the hardcore facts of him being a pig and ending up as bacon. I mean, those are, we all know people like that that are in our lives. So I think it works because we can couch those characteristics in animals and not find fault with the author for giving someone those characteristics that we might think are maybe we shouldn't be poking fun at. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Let me ask you something else. As you were talking, I was thinking, so does that mean, you know, do geese behave that way? Because in our world, we look at geese and they seem to just be acting that way. And so when you're writing about geese in the way that E.B. White was, then you have to kind of give geese their due. Or, you know, is it that a sheep couldn't do those same things because of the way we view them? So you were talking about being sheep being fearful and, you know, geese being noisy. Do you think that it also goes to how we view certain kinds of animals and what we've, is there a commonality in what we think about their behavior, I guess is what I'm wondering.
Well, for better or worse, there could be. That could, absolutely. I think that's very personal to the author. One person writing a book about a crow might think they're loud and not aggressive, but, you know, a little bit pushy. Another person will know a crow from a totally different way. That they collect beautiful shiny objects or how they rear their young. So I think the opportunity is certainly not to sounds funny to not stereotype these animals, but I think that they were devices for E.B. White to tell his story. And I think to some degree we do lump them into certain ways of behaving, but I'm sure there's a pretty wide range there.
Yeah, and I guess in a way, maybe, you know, doubling back on that one, answering it in a way too, Charlotte would not be, you know, a hero in many quarters, being a spider and all.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And that could be.
So yes, it's really interesting. So let me also touch on, you know, one of the things that you touched on early on was just about how E.B. White was writing all different kinds of things from the beginning. And there's a page in the book where there's a little list here of, you know, where it says sold a sonnet for $5 about a horse that won the Kentucky Derby. And, you know, and then did other things like sandpaper to dance floor. So it was kind of like there was this whole thing about mixing in, you know, writing all the time, but with all the other things in his life.
Yeah, the piece you're referring to is a map when E.B. White and a college friend took a trip cross country, mm-hmm. and they considered themselves very much budding writers. They fixed up their Model T Ford with two typewriters and just the essential camping gear and went off to have some fun and pay for the trip along the way with their writing. So they were game for anything at all. And, you know, so in order to eat or get food at a restaurant, you know, they would pay for the sand floor, picked pears, did all sorts of things along the way. He played piano in a cafe. And I think what I love about that is that he did this at a time when he had many responsibilities. He was a little bit footloose. I remember being that age myself where everything we owned fit in the back of a car. And we just could explore without feeling like we had to get back home for any reason. So I think that was a really interesting time. But he had also, by that time, he was in his early 20s, and he had done a fair amount of writing. He had gone to Cornell and was the editor of his school newspaper. So I think he had his hand in a lot of pies, but it's interesting, too, to think how little money they needed to get by on that trip, you know, $3 here and $7 there and son and typewriter, et cetera. So it's, I, that too, this this is a thread in the book that describes all that we just spoke about. And it was, for me, the device of using a map to tell that story rather than having it told in the text. So for certain kinds of readers, that was just a great way to talk about this 6 month period in his life to compress it into this fun map of a legend that describes it.
And one of the things you alluded to, which I thought was interesting, you know, also in the context of young people becoming writers, I mean, there were a lot of opportunities to try to get, you know, your work published. I mean, you talk about the St. Nicholas magazine when you, mm-hmm. you know, for very young. And I think in a way there was a desire among young people to be able to put your work out there, and there were formats to do it. Same with illustration in certain ways at that time, right?
Exactly, yeah. Well, I think it goes back to a question of what did kids do for entertainment back then? So getting St. Nicholas magazine in the mail on a monthly basis must have been a great day, because you had a month's worth of fabulous, not only science and English, fun English essays, but all the stuff that the kids added to St. Nicholas. It wasn't just a kids' magazine. It was a magazine for kids, but kids added to it in a big way. I can't imagine how much fun that would have been to receive that in the mail. So, yeah, I think there were, but I also think kids spent their time maybe in a different way. Not an authority on that, but they made their own fun, and that was something that would have been fun, was to try their hand at a short essay or submit a drawing. We had, I'm pretty sure Highlights magazine had that when I was growing up, at least a little bit. There's certain magazines that definitely had that option. Mm-hmm. But what I'm noticing, I'm not well versed as to whether or not that's something that kids can do today. I'm sure they can. But what I'm noticing going into schools, even from, I would say, 10 years ago, kids are writing so much more. I am blown away by how much all different kinds of writing they're doing. They're journaling and making books and essays, etc. It's been really impressive and wonderful, enlightening to see it this fall when I went to a number of schools. So it was exciting.
Yeah. And also short form writing is having a particular period now, right? You talk about E.B. White doing a lot of short form writing.
Like poetry, poetry slams, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, one of the periods you talk about is when he worked with James Thurber and was at The New Yorker, which was obviously a very pivotal period. What do you think about that in the context of how he grew as a writer?
Well, when Harold Ross, who started The New Yorker, he was a newspaper man, and he had this idea. He had many ideas. His idea for The New Yorker was this fun weekly magazine, and I'm not sure he even knew exactly what it would be, but being in New York, E.B. White was beginning to submit his pieces. So Harold Ross and Catherine Angel, the fiction editor, began to see E.B. White's work in various publications. And they knew that was the voice, that was the voice of, one of the voices they wanted in The New Yorker. So he was just a young man then. It was after he made that cross-country trip, came back and was making his way in New York, and long story short, ended up with a part-time, then a full-time job at The New Yorker. He shared an office with James Thurber, and this was an interesting period for a lot of reasons. Both James Thurber and Andy White, Andy was his nickname by then, really fed off each other. They both had a really wry sense of humor. So, and I'm sure their work had to be done quickly, like any, you know, weekly. They were working fast. They were working in all sorts of forms as well. And they were, I guess you could say they were sort of cutting their teeth at the New Yorker, finding the way to write that they ended up doing a lot more of it as time went on. When Gerber becoming a humorist and cartoonist, and E.B. White going on to do essays and short pieces. But one of the, I won't say it was a dilemma, but some writer had, we had a page count as we always do in a children's book, and I wanted so badly to expand that New Yorker chapter. There was so much that I wanted to say about the New Yorker, but it was almost as if that was a different book. That was another book. So but it was imperative to touch on it because that was a pivotal point in his writing career. So, and when I was growing up, we had the New Yorker Book of Cartoons, so I was especially eager to not just research, but include it in my book.
Yeah, no, I heard when you were saying that, I thought, huh, that's sounding like another book, so I guess it could be. what about, he had one of the, you know, most special opportunities to be edited by Ursula Nordstrom at Harper, and that's something that every author, I think, can dream about, having that sure. type of an editor. So what about that relationship?
He met Ursula Nordstrom because his original editor at Harper's had passed away, and he was ready to publish Stuart Little, I believe. And don't quote me on that. I'll have to go back and look. But nonetheless, Ursula became his editor. Mm-hmm. Yes, she was the editor for Maurice Sendak and dozens of other memorable people who, you know, we think of as the icons of children's literature now. And I think she totally got E.B. White, and she loved his stuff. I think between E.B. White and Ursula, they felt they also wanted Garth Williams. So we're looking back on this wonderful history of children's literature. I don't know how that will look today, who will look at as the iconic editors and illustrators and writers that have come together in my lifetime. But then she was just a sparkling editor to my mind. She had a great wit, and I think she took risks and could see in E.B. White that he had, he had a great way of crafting a story for children. And it wasn't necessarily typical, but again, I think she was willing to take any risk.
So, what about the relationship to that piece of it? We were talking very much in the beginning. We touched on the art. So what about that in-house and how the art that you chose to do for your book? You were pulling from a lot of different things. You were pulling from images from the books that he had and also just things that felt very classic to the period.
Yes. Early on when the idea came to me, I went home. Well, it was immediate. I went home and took off my shelf the letters of E.B. White. And in reading that, I thought, immediately, I thought, how can I say this any better, with any more clarity or as beautifully as E.B. White? Nobody can become the person they're writing about. So I thought, well, I'm just going to include these quotes as part of my story. I'll let him have center stage, punctuate the book with his essays. And that essays, letters, pieces of any of his work. And that turned out to be the best idea of all, because it gave me a form, first of all, and a hierarchy. There would be my writing, and then where I could, I would punctuate my story in his own words. So that required reading basically everything I could get my hands on that he wrote and reading it a number of times. And I'm not a very organized person, so I didn't have a fancy software or any way of addressing when I found something. I would be so excited. Sometimes I would rip it out of a book and tack it to my wall. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I copied it. I had more than one copy of a lot of things because some books were just up for grabs. Like they were part of my process and I needed to cut them up or tack them up as needed. So there was that. So I found those quotes and set them aside. But then a design question came up for me early on, and that was how to address what they were going to look like. Are these poems going to be in a different font? Suddenly, as a text, it was getting very long. So I thought, well, I wanted to try typing them up on a manual typewriter, just like he did, mm-hmm. for two reasons. One, I wanted to slow down enough to feel what it felt like to be in touch with his sentences word by word. So to type them up was the best way to do that. And then visually, it distinguished them from my text. Another layer on that was that I thought they should be illustrated. So they became the illustrated quotes with a small label on each one, identifying where that quote came from in the year. And that clues the reader into going to find the full passage or full letter, et cetera, and the year it was written, because it's important to know that something I put in his childhood, he didn't write in his childhood. And so then the book began to take shape with these various elements. The White family, Martha White, his granddaughter, is a friend of mine, and she opened up the archival floodgates to me. It was really remarkable. I was able to see Amy White's sketchbooks, home movies, anything I needed. She was right there at the ready, providing it for me. So I had a lot of access to the manuscripts and photographs and letters and some things that had never been published. And one is a favorite one of mine from Catherine Angel, the fiction editor at The New Yorker, wrote to him. And she became, of course, Mrs. White, Andy's wife. And I love that that letter was included, not just for the historical piece, but and the New Yorker history, but because it was the beginning of their relationship too. So that kind of thing just doesn't happen every day. And I felt like the whole thing was, this whole book and my working on it was just charmed from the get-go. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah.
It was kind of magical. It really unfolded. But also it took time. And that is, this wasn't a book I could rush. I had to wait and keep working to feel what was feeling right about it. And I know that sounds kind of fuzzy, but there is a moment where you know you nail something. And you have to keep waiting for that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because as you were talking, I mean, the page that I had particularly flagged, one of them was just a two-page spread of The Trumpet of the Swan, and mm-hmm. and had thought, you know, how beautifully done it is, because what you have is the cover of the book on one side, you have your text, and then you flow right into the typewriter type text, and then the little tag below it of the date and the title, and it's just, you know, and you have a musical score. It's just in a design, like you can just sit there and look at it as a piece of art. The whole spread is just beautifully, beautifully done, and it's that kind of feeling throughout. I guess what struck me in what you were doing by flowing between these things is that really what you did was you made it feel seamless between what was the book and sort of the pullouts of things plus what you were adding to it and your words and his. I just thought so much of it was beautifully, beautifully thought out.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the design of most of our books should feel seamless, or we're paying too much attention to the design. The design allows us to know where we are in a place in the book, and helps the book to flow. It makes it fun and interesting to get to the next page, etc. All those seamless details are decisions made along the way. And thanks for noticing. And it is one of the really fun things about making a book, I find, though, is figuring that out. That it's there. Every book is really different that way. And you know, this solution for this book is nothing like the solution for the next book. But if the person who you write, for instance, the biography, if the person and where they lived, the era, the materials are all part of that, are all working together, and I think what I'm looking for is, am I trying to be clever, or am I using this because I want to, or am I doing this because it's in service of the book and the design? So I have to be careful not to. I'm careful not to just make it fun for me. I really want it, and it is fun for me. Mm-hmm. But I want it to be. I want to choose carefully, and I think we do as illustrators. Those decisions we make are all pointing to being a marriage with our text.
Which leads me to the question I had wanted to ask you too, which is how does your process work between writing and illustrating?
There's never been one way I've done it. This is my fourth book, and the difference between writing and illustrating my own work and illustrating someone else's is night and day. Even though I do a lot of research for any nonfiction book I'm doing, there's something about doing both that I think it has the ability to be even more seamless, even though we want it to be seamless no matter what. But my process is messy. It is messy because I get very excited about what I'm reading. And I don't keep good, like I mentioned earlier, I don't keep good tabs on anything. I'm so excited I can hardly sometimes write it all down. Everything's by hand. I'm not jotting things down on the computer. The computer doesn't really even enter into it for me. It's all on paper, on vertical walls, on horizontal surfaces. But that's part of the beauty of serendipity. There's some serendipity there too. So just like in making a collage piece, the nature of collage is you might see a piece of paper out of the corner of your eye. You don't have necessarily everything you need right in front of you. So that's how I feel when I'm writing and illustrating. I begin writing. I'll do a little bit of artwork. With the artwork, I'll think I want to. I don't need to say this in the story because I can put it in the art, but describing how even an insert writer, how E.B. White's quotes came to be illustrated, you can sense that it's really by the seat of my pants. Part of it is solving a problem for me, like how am I going to do this? So I work back and forth, but eventually the story has to be written and time needs to be set aside to do that. That doesn't mean I'm not collecting materials or thinking about how I'm going to illustrate. I knew in some writer early on, I wanted to write about how E.B. White's three children's books came to be. And in that, in reading those books and listening to them on audio for a long, long time, about a year, it's just incessantly going, you know, reading them over and over and listening over and over, I came upon a passage from each one that I felt was exemplified each story, and I knew I wanted to do a collage around that passage, say from Stuart Little, because I didn't want someone coming to some writer to have to try to remember the story of Stuart Little, or that they hadn't even read it before. I've met plenty of people who haven't read Stuart Little. And so those devices are an opportunity to make a more comprehensive book and to be a bit of a gift to the reader. Like, I'm not expecting anybody to know anything, starting from scratch. So that was an idea early on, and then fleshed out when I got to that point in the book that I needed to think more about those large three-dimensional collages.
Now, go ahead, finish that.
No, it's just an example of, those sorts of things don't just appear. They're like started way back, like kind of an archaeological dig when you think about going back to how that began. It's funny, because they seem like they were always meant to be, but not really. You have to kind of conjure up how you want it to look.
Now, I wanted to, before we close, there are a couple things I wanted to do. First, wanted to mention some of your more recent books, although I do want to touch back on one that I've always been fond of, your Balloons Over Broadway about the Macy's Parade, which is a very fun book. And one that we've talked about here, because I had spoken with Michelle Markell about Brave Girl, about mm-hmm. the shirtwaist maker's strike. And then more recently, you have a book called Firefly July and You Nest Here With Me. And the one that I skipped in the middle but haven't forgotten is The Right Word, which is maybe a companion in some ways to this because it's about Roget and the thesaurus, which is kind of fun. Mm-hmm. But tell me what you're working on now.
Right now, I am working on a book by Kwame Alexander, and it's in a nutshell, it's a book-length poem, and my drafting table is covered with a white sheet of paper, and I'm just playing and mapping it out visually. So it's kind of the polar opposite of some writer and the perfect next book. So it's pretty exciting, actually.
Now, I was going to say that people should definitely look for these. Let me ask you before I, because you gave me the chance, is there anything else that you'd like to touch on before we go? Thoughts for maybe young people looking for books and learning more about writing?
Let me think for a second. I bought so many books when the holidays come. I just read Moo by Sharon Creech, which I loved.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding that there are two other books that I really loved. And I don't know if they're about writing or about how interesting ways to tell a story. And I think that all that is about writing in a way. One is Jesse Hartland did a book called Insanely Great about Steve Jobs. And I love reading about Steve Jobs because he's in our life. Anybody who uses a Mac basically has Steve Jobs in his life. And I love her biography on him. And it was a wonderful way to illustrate a biography. And the other book I loved was Lucy by Randy Cecil, which is almost like a graphic novel. What I'm noticing about books more recently is the production, the kind of paper they're using, and the length. They're a little bit longer than we're used to, and I love that too. But one thing that happened for me this past fall in going to the school, it was this amazing program here in Maine, and 650 students that I saw all got a copy of Some Writer. And they were all ages from kindergarten through high school. And I think that the best case scenario was that all these kids went back and either heard Charlotte's Web again or read Charlotte's Web again, and it was an opportunity to reread E.B. White or see him anew. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend that. I just recommend touching base with his three children's books again. And then the high school kids were reading some of his essays and looking at how sensory they were, how you could feel yourself where he was, the smells of the woods, the sound of the water, all those small details in his essays. And then they went on to do a hike and came back and wrote their own essays. So I feel like his work is as rich and ripe as it was the day he wrote it. And so I would just urge kids to, in a way, have fun dissecting someone's work and finding out what about it interests them and where is it memorable for them. So writing should be fun. So I guess I will leave it at that.
Okay. And what I'm gonna hope is that when people buy their baby gift books of Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little and all of that, that they'll buy some writer along with it, because it's a book to grow up with and understand. E.B. White, and as you were saying, you know, I think both can go hand in hand through many different ages. So,
yes.
But thank you so much for this. This is a delight, and, you know, truly I hope people will take a look at the book and also your other books. And let me also say they can find your work at melissasweet.net. Anything else they should know in terms of looking for you?
No, I think you can find me there, and you can find me on Facebook, and you can write me a simple snail mail. That all works. So thank you. Thank you. I love to hear from readers.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again, Melissa, so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Okay.
Take care.